Good afternoon. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It was a great pleasure to be here. The work I want to present today has been done in collaboration with a few bunch of people. So the first part of this work was done with people at ICFO, so Rodrigo Gallego, Chris Hadley, and Antonio Assin, and indeed Rodrigo and Tony are here. Then the second bit is with John Barrett and Christian Gogolin, who are also here. And the final bit is with Marcin Pawlowski, who unfortunately cannot be here. Right. So maybe let me tell you first a few words why we started getting interested in these questions. So the initial motivation was the question of how can you assess the Hilbert space dimension of a quantum system in an experiment. So suppose you realize some experiment and you see things are going on, and somehow the Hilbert space dimension of the system captures its complexity, and just by observing what's going on in the experiment, you would like to say something about this Hilbert space dimension. So somehow it's like the opposite of the usual approach, where you come out with a theoretical model and you say, okay, so this is my model, this is the Hilbert space, this is my state, it evolves like this, and you know, this is what I observe. So here it's the opposite. So we want to take the observed data and say something about the model. So there were a few approaches that tend to address this problem. So the first one was in the context of Bell inequalities. Because indeed in a Bell test, in non-locality, you get statistics from an experiment on space-like separated entangled particles. And the idea, if you want, is roughly the following. So if you do a Bell test with two entangled qubits, you may achieve a certain amount of non-locality in your correlation, certain amount of violation of a Bell inequality. But now if you have access to a pair of entangled qubits, you may be able to get stronger correlations, so a larger amount of violation of a Bell inequality. And indeed, this works, and this is just an example of such a test of dimensionality. Then there was a second approach, which is due to Stephanie Weiner, Matthias Christandl, and Andrew Doherty, which made a relation between this problem and random access codes. And the idea is roughly that in order to have a good code, you need to have a large dimensional system somehow. So, but I'll come back to this later. And finally, there was a third approach by Michael Wolf and David Perez Garcia, and they considered a dynamical situation. So there is a system and it evolves in time according to some evolution. And then you would monitor the expectation value of some observables. And then from this sort of time series, you could infer something on the dimensionality. So all these three approaches are nice, but they have drawbacks. So for instance, the first one, it's based on non-locality. So if you would have the case of a single quantum system, you would not be able to say anything. The second approach, it has drawbacks in the sense that the bounds are not always very useful and they may be hard to compute. And the third approach, well, it has the problem that it needs evolution. If you're in a static scenario, then you can't say anything. So here, basically, we want to somehow look at the following setup, which is somehow the simplest situation here. So is there a pointer? Maybe this. I have to remove the USB stick from the bottom. Oh,
it should work now.
Oh, great, thanks. Right. So we imagine the following setup. So we would have two black boxes. So the first one is this one here. We call the state preparator. So what does this box do? Well, it features a certain number of knobs. So here we have n knobs. And when we press knob X, there is a state that a particle in a specific state here, rho X, that comes out of the box. And so the only thing that we demand is that each time I press button X, I have the state rho X coming out. It's not the, the it, it's not something completely random in each run of the experiment, otherwise I can't say anything. But for instance, could be the cases that two different knobs produce the same state. That would be perfectly fine here. So upon request, I create some state here, and then this state goes into another box, which we call the measuring device. And this box has also a certain number of knobs here, M knobs, and allows me to perform a measurement on the system, and eventually I get some outcome here. Right. And now, so I repeat this experiment many, many, many times. So I get access to the statistics. So I get access to the probabilities of having outcome B here, given any pair of preparation and measurement. And now what I would like to do is to make a device-independent statement, that is, regardless of what is here inside those boxes, about the dimensionality of this state rho x. And, okay, I shall be interested in quantum systems, but I will also be interested in classical systems. And now we go directly to the first two words of the title, so data tables, which you may remember from John Barrett's talk of the other day. Well, so a data table is just now a convenient way of writing down this probability distribution. So horizontally here, I'm going to put my different preparations, so preparation one, preparation two. Vertically here, they are the measurements, measurement M1. So here I'm going to restrict to binary outcomes, plus one and minus one, measurement two. And now I can fill in the table by putting the relevant probabilities, and this is my data table. So now, again, the question is, given a data table, how can I find useful bounds on the classical or quantum dimensions of systems that are necessary to reproduce such a table? And another class of questions is whether I can find data tables which are sort of relatively easy to do with quantum systems but would require very high dimensional classical systems. This was the topic of John Barrett's talk, so one can get such a separation between quantum and classical dimension. And the last question which I'm interested in here is whether this sort of quantum advantage, whether this separation can be useful for something, like information processing, for instance. All right, and yeah, let me mention that I guess the first appearance of this sort of data tables in this is in his 2007 paper here. All right, so here what I'm going to do is present you some formalisms, some simple methods to do these device-independent tests of classical and quantum dimensions, and I'll try to convince you that these techniques are somehow useful from a foundational point of view, because as John showed the other day, they may allow us to say something about ontological models and quantum mechanics. And also, I will talk about some ideas for applications in QKD, so that's much more applied somehow. All right, so let me start with the task of testing classical systems. So that means that the state that comes out of my state preparator here, lambda x, is a classical state, let's say, of dimension d. And what I mean by that is that it's a probability distribution over bits. So for instance, the state 0 is fine, the state 1 is fine, the state d minus 1 is fine. But I could also have, I could also flip a coin here inside this box and send the state 0 with probability 50% and the state 1 with 50%. That is fine. Right. Now, instead of using the probabilities, I'm going to write everything in terms of these expectation values, so these correlators. So it's simply the expectation value for any pair of preparation X and measurement Y. And now I'm going to think of experiments as some vectors E, and indeed each experiment is simply characterized by the set of all possible expectation values for any pair of preparation and measurement. So now what I would like to design here is objects like this, which we call dimension witnesses. So it's a functional of these vectors of experiments here. And So basically, it's a linear combination of these expectation values with some coefficients here. And then there is some bound here, C index D, which is the maximum value that this particular combination can take whenever the state here emitted by the preparator is classical and of dimension D. Right. So in some sense, this is very reminiscent of Bell inequalities, because it's linear. And so in some sense, you can think of these dimension witnesses as Bell inequalities for data tables. And instead of testing locality, they test dimensionality somehow. Right. So I'm going to show you how one approach to find useful inequalities of this form. So we are going to think in terms of geometrical terms. So in a very close spirit to what is done in non-locality with, you know, these polytopes of local correlations, as you have seen in previous talks. So again, now I'm going to view these experiments as some vectors in a high-dimensional space. And I'm going to try to represent the various sets of correlations that I can achieve depending on the dimensionality of the system that I send. So first of all, a simple observation is that if the number of preparations is smaller or equal than the dimensionality which I would like to test, then basically nothing interesting is going to happen. And why is that? Well, it's quite easy to see. If the information about which preparation I chose here can be encoded in this particle, well, then this second box has the whole information about the preparation and the measurement. So basically, it can simulate any experiment. So that's not interesting. So therefore, we need to focus on the case where there are more preparations than the dimensionality we wish to test. All right. Ooh. All right, so let's have a look. So indeed, in practice, it's much more complicated. This is just like a simple sketch. So imagine that we have a scenario where we have three preparations. So I know that with a classical trait, I can do all possible experiments. So by the way, this set is a polytope because it has a finite number of extremal points, extremal experiments, which are simply deterministic experiments. So where all the expectation values are 1 or minus 1. Right. Now, what happens is that if I start restricting the dimensionality of the system, not all extremal points are feasible. So for instance, if I only send a classical bit instead of a trait, there is some experiment here which I will not be able to do. So therefore, I get a smaller set here. And now I'm interested in the facets of this smaller set. Because these facets, they define inequalities, which strictly characterize the set of experiments that are realizable with a bit. And in particular, I will be interested in these tight witnesses, because since they really define the facets of this polytope, they are somehow the minimal set of inequalities which I need in order to characterize this set. So here, there is one subtle point, which is the following. So in order for the set here to be a polytope, I need to be able to do mixtures between any of these deterministic points. And that requires me to add something in this picture here, which is shared randomness. So in this case, I'm allowing for shared randomness between the state preparator and the measuring device. So it's important, indeed, that this shared randomness does not depend on the inputs here, but that's all. As far as this is concerned, shared randomness is allowed. So you may say, well, okay, but why are you doing this? So I think there are two reasons. So the first one is that as we are trying to do a device-independent statement, if we test an even stronger model, it's good for us. There is no problem. And indeed, the second reason is that it becomes much easier. If we don't allow for shared randomness, then the set of experiments that can be done with a bit is not convex anymore, so its boundary might be something like this here. And characterizing it is kind of a really hard problem. Indeed, it would be really interesting for future work, but Here, we restrict to this case. All right. So this, I guess, is somehow what I explained already. So the facets of this polytope define these dimension witnesses, which are of this form. And then, indeed, this immediately leads to the extension to the quantum case, because now I simply can take the same kind of expressions here, and I can try to find what is the optimal quantum value that I can get for these expressions with q dits, right? And, well, as you may guess, and see already from the picture here, so in general, for a given d, quantum systems allow to do more, so the set of experiments becomes larger, and it's typically something like this, so it's not really a polytope anymore, but it's like a roundish set. And then, indeed, a quantum dimension witness is something that sort of, so in this case, it's a linear one, so it sort of fits on the quantum set. One can also devise non-linear quantum witnesses, but it's beyond interest here. All right, so let me give you an example. So this is the simplest possible case. I have three preparations and two measurements. And, well, here you can take a computer and resolve the polytope, and you can find that there is only one facet, which is an inequality, which is of this form. And from now on, I will write inequalities in a form that is reminiscent of the data tables here. And so basically the way I should read this is this plus sign here, it means that the term where I have the first preparation and the first measurement should come with a sign plus. So indeed, it's what happens. If I take this one, third preparation, second measurement, has a sign minus. Right. So first of all, if I have three preparations with a classical trait, I can achieve any possible experiment. So indeed, here I have five terms in this expression. I can make them all with the correct sign, so I get five. Now, by sending a classical bit, I cannot. And it's quite easy to see. Let's focus on deterministic experiment. So imagine, so if I have to send a classical bit here, it means that there are, for two of these preparations, I will have to send the same value of the bit. So let's suppose I send the value 0 for preparation 1 and 0 for preparation 2. Well, then you see that I send the same instruction here. However, the behavior according to the measurement should be different. So, of course, I will not be able to maximize this expression. And if, on the other hand, I send 0 for this state and 1 for those two, well, then, indeed, I have a problem because I will not be able, so here also the instructions are incompatible. So I guess I get this frustration. Now, with qubits, it becomes interesting because with qubits, I can perform much better than with classical bits. The optimal preparations and measurements are given here. So this is like sort of circle on the Bloch sphere. And, well, you see that the angles here are such that all of these terms here will be 1 over root 2. So there will be this 2 root 2 term, and the final one can be made equal to 1. So one thing that you can see here is that if it was not for this last line here, this inequality would look very much like the CHSH inequality. And so one may wonder whether this CHSH inequality might be a witness, which might be simpler than this one. And this cannot be the case, because remember, if the number of preparations is equal to the dimensionality, I can always just send this information. And this is what makes the difference between these dimension witnesses and what is called Bell inequalities in time, like the Leggett-Garg inequality, is that these inequalities here are not device independent in the sense that they require additional assumptions like no disturbance on the measurements and things like this. So that's the difference. All right, so far what we have seen is that there are these tools to assess dimensionalities, and that there are data tables which can be done with quantum systems of a given dimension, but not with classical systems of the same dimensionality. So there is this notion of a quantum advantage, something where quantum does better than classical. And indeed now, the question is, what can we do with that? So indeed, one thing that we can do is well, find interesting results from the foundational point of view, like this exponential separation. Another thing is this, that we can look at one-way QKD and design a kind of novel type of proof. Right, so, okay, I don't want to say too much about this because John explained already everything, but this, so basically this separation between classical and quantum dimensionalities can be done even in the case where small errors are tolerated. So it's a result that is sort of robust, and it's very much related to communication complexity. Right. So let me move on now. So the next case where these ideas of dimension witnesses find an application is QKD. So here is somehow the usual QKD scenario. So Alice has a box here, encodes some information into quantum states. So these are the various preparations that Alice may use. The quantum state here is emitted. At the other end of the channel, Bob is doing a measurement and tries to retrieve the bit encoded by Alice by doing this measurement. And in the middle, there is Eve here, who can basically do whatever she wants. So here, we want to... everything has moved in the slides for some reasons, but whatever. So here we want to focus on a scenario which we called semi-device independent. So what does that mean? In a device-independent scenario, we would make no assumption whatsoever on the devices used. Here, we call it semi-device-independent because we assume that the dimensionality of the preparations made by Alice is bounded. So we work here with qubits, for instance. However, we will not assume, contrary to usual proof of QKD, that the preparations are characterized. So the preparations can be any qubit state. This is perfectly fine. On the other hand of the channel, Bob is fully device independent. No assumption is made on Bob. Right. So what we can do with this is we can prove security against a kind of simple type of attacks, individual attacks. And the security will be based on the violation of some dimension witness. So in usual QKD, security is based on the violation of some entanglement witness. In device-independent key distribution, it's based on the violation of a Bell inequality. And here, it's based on these ideas of dimension witnesses. And somehow what is interesting is that, at least as far as I know, it is the first sort of proof, even though it's for a simple case for now, but is the first kind of proof that applies directly to the one-way situation. So in all of the QKD proofs, you always start from the one-way configuration, then devise the related entanglement-based version, and then use some arguments of monogamy or something like this. All right. Okay, so as a sort of warm-up, I wanted to start with the case of BB84, and which somehow shows what the point is here. So we want to assess security simply from the data table, right? Because it should be semi-device independent. So in BB84, we have four preparations, these plus Z, minus Z, plus X, minus X, two measurements, which look like this on the block sphere. And now if I do the data table, well, for preparation one and measurement one, the outcome is certain, it's always plus one. For measurement two and preparation one, well, it's completely random because then I measure in the X basis, and so on and so on, and you see that this is the data table. However, it turns out that this data table does not violate any dimension witness. So it means that it can actually be simulated by sending a classical bit. So of course there can be no security in this semi-device independent sense because, I mean, if Eve is able to program the devices such that the correct probability distribution here can be simulated with one bit, then she gets all the information. So no security. And there is actually a quite simple strategy to simulate this data table. Maybe I can go quickly through it. So here we have four preparations, which is best to express somehow as, or to denote by two bits, A0 and A1. The first one, as you can see here, denotes the basis. So here I have 0 and 0 for P1 and P4, so first basis. And then the second bit denotes the outcomes. And then the strategy is as follows. So Alice and Bob share one bit of shared randomness. So if lambda is 0, Alice sends the message A0 plus A1, one-bit message, and Bob outputs M plus Y, so his input. So then if Alice and Bob measure in the same basis, then the outcomes are perfectly correlated, and if not, they are perfectly anti-correlated. And now when lambda is 1, Alice simply sends her output, and then by having this variable here being unbiased, well, we see that we reproduce exactly this data table. Right. So, okay, nothing to do with BB84 and nothing to do with all protocols which are based on the same states. So like the SARG protocol, for instance, and others. So now let's see a protocol that works. And the protocol is worked on this dimension witness here. Right. So if I would do now a simple reasoning like I did before, I could convince you that for a classical bit, the upper limit here is given by 4, but actually I'm going to do something a bit more elegant. So what one can do is that this dimension witness is exactly a random access code, actually. So let's see how this goes. So let me denote again the four preparations here by two bits, A0 and A1. Right. So now in a random access code, the goal is that whenever Bob is given measurement 1 or measurement 2, he is asked to guess the value of bit 0, well, the first or the second bit of Alice here. And now you see immediately that this table here is exactly correlated to the values of the encoding here. So therefore, if you achieve a very high score for this witness, you have a very good random access encoding. And well, one can make this really quantitative. So the probability of Bob guessing correctly the bit of Alice, so the figure of merit of this random access code, is just a linear function of the value of this witness. So that means that you get a data table. From this data table, you compute the value, which I call I here, of this witness. And this tells you immediately how good your experiment is as a random access code. And well, indeed, it's clear that the limit here that we get for the witness for classical bits just coincides exactly to the maximal probability of guessing for a classical random access code when Alice sends one bit. Right. So now the nice thing is that indeed in quantum mechanics, one can do better. And the best guessing probability that Bob can achieve by when Alice sends qubits is 0.85, so cos square of pi over 8. And indeed, the preparations and the measurements that are used in this setup are represented here. And, well, if you remember Stephanie's talk of yesterday, she presented exactly the same setup. So this is like the usual 1 out of 2 random access code using qubits. Right. So, let me also here point out that, in this paper that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, there is also a connection that is established between random access code and dimension witnesses, but it's slightly different. It involves entropic quantities, and, it's like a different and interesting approach. Right, so now we are going to see that this dimension witness here leads to security. Right. So we want security against individual attacks. So therefore, we are going to use some results by Cesar and Kerner from 1978. and which says that if we can show that the mutual information between Alice Bob is larger than that between Alice and Eve, we get security. And in order to do that, we are going to show that the probability for Bob to guess Alice's bit is larger than that of Eve, and that will be enough. So the proof is based on a very nice result by Robert Koenig, which you can find in his PhD thesis, and which says the following thing. So consider Fn here, the set of balanced Boolean functions on n bit strings. So that means, balanced means that for half of the inputs, for half of the possible input bit strings, you get the value 0, and for the other half, you get the value 1. So it's balanced on the inputs. So it goes like this. So Alice receives a uniformly chosen n-bit string. Bob receives a function uniformly chosen in this set. Alice is allowed to send s qubits to Bob, and then Bob's probability of guessing is bounded by this expression here, which depends on s and on n. Right. Of guessing the value of the function on this n bit string. Right. Okay, so now we apply this to our case. So we have a simple case, n equal 2, s equal 1. And so for 2 bits, the balanced functions are those ones, a0, a1, and a0 plus a1, and their negations. But indeed, the probability of guessing the negation is the same as the original function. And then we get this bound here from this result of Koenig. So now, indeed, we go like this. So first of all, we are interested in evaluating this expression here. So note that now it contains not only Bob, but also Eve. But indeed, if we assume that Bob and Eve collaborate, this is fine. So first, we develop this term here. So the probability of guessing the XOR is larger than that of guessing both bits. Then we use the sum rule here. And then we get this expression where actually we would still have the Bob-Eve indices here. But then indeed, the probability of knowing bit, of guessing bit AI for Bob and Eve together will be larger than that of just Bob guessing correctly. And then we get an expression like this. And then using here the result of Koenig, we get this kind of inequality here. And this is quite interesting because it says that if Eve has a, so the higher the probability for Eve to guess bit A1, the lower that of Bob to guess bit A0. And somehow this is reminiscent of what happens in, you know, in usual QKD. I mean, if Eve measures in the wrong basis, she introduces errors, and then she gets detected. So I think this captures somehow the same idea here. Right, so then we can just derive the other inequality where the two bits here are exchanged, and then we can average, and we get this inequality here, which limits the sum of the probabilities of Bob and Eve of guessing the input of Alice. And now, indeed, if the probability of Bob of guessing is larger than half of this quantity here, well, then we know that indeed we get this relation, which by Cesar and Kerner shows that it's secure. And now the very nice thing is that the gap is small, but there is a little gap. So because qubits, as we saw before, so as we saw here, so using this scheme here, we can get a probability for Bob of guessing, which is of the order of 85%. So it's slightly higher than this value. So there is a regime where we can show security. Right. So now let me make a few comments on this. So indeed, you may wonder how relevant somehow these ideas are. So from an applied point of view, it may actually be quite appealing somehow, because in this case, so we have seen that Alice, so the device of Alice is semi-device independent. That means that the preparations are assumed to be of a fixed dimension, but apart from that, they are uncharacterized. So compared to usual security proofs, where you not only assume the dimensionality, but also the fact that when you prepare the state plus z, it's really plus z, but if you have small errors, this may lead to loopholes or things like this. So from that point of view, it's quite appealing to say just, okay, you have qubits, but they can be whatever you want. Now, indeed, Bob here is fully device independent, so nothing is assumed on Bob, so that's also quite nice. So in that sense, this kind of proof represents a relaxation compared to usual proofs. So in that sense, quite interesting. Also, it works for the one-way configuration, which is the one that is always used in implementations, so almost always used in implementations of key distributions. So I don't know, maybe it's also quite interesting somehow. Indeed, well, the drawback so far is that it's only valid for very specific type of attacks, so what can we say about more general ones? And indeed, also the drawback is that this gap that we have for security is very small presently, so maybe the key rate is going to be quite bad. And okay, but I think that's somehow not the point here. I would somehow say that the most interesting thing about it is that it's really like a new type of proof for QKD because it works in this one-way configuration. All right, so with this, I'm almost at the end. So I told you about data tables and presented you some ideas and methods on how to put bounds on classical and quantum dimensions in order to reproduce these data tables. And then I argued that this is quite technical, but actually these ideas are quite interesting because they allow us to say things from foundational point of view. For instance, this separation between quantum and classical dimensions, and also about more applied things like QKD. And to finish, I would like to point out a few open questions. So the first one is related to some topic which is quite popular here in PI. So it's contextuality, in particular preparation contextuality. And, well, so it's quite vague at the moment, so I don't have much more to say than what I'm going to say now, but it seems to me that contextuality captures something about dimension. So when you say that a model is non-contextual, it means that your system has information only about the measurement outcomes, but not about the context in which these measurement outcomes may occur. So somehow that means that if you want to make the model contextual, you need to put in more information, because you need to put in the information about the context as well. So somehow it might be that these two things are somehow related. And so for instance, it would be nice to see if the tests, so the sort of inequalities that have been designed to test preparation contextuality could be related to these witnesses, for instance. Another open somehow question, which is also somehow related more to this nice conference, is about generalized models. So here we have only restricted to classical and quantum systems, but indeed one may ask similar questions for generalized models. And so here also I don't have much to say, but maybe one thing that I can say is the following. So for instance, considering this scheme again, so this random access encoding, by going to generalized models, I mean, for instance, the following. So if you consider PR box correlations and you cut it in two, you have a system which is generally represented by a square because it has four pure states, and it's a two-dimensional system because two is the number of states which I can distinguish by a measurement. And indeed, this sort of half PR box, it has the nice property that it achieves a perfect random access encoding. So it gets to the largest possible violation of this dimension witness. And somehow, these ideas seem to be quite related to what is done in the context of non-locality, for instance, where random access codes also have something to say about the power of correlations, for instance, like in the principle of information causality. So, yeah, I think it would be quite nice to see what is the exact relation between all these topics. All right, with this, I thank you.
Okay, we've got lots of time for questions if people have them. Okay, yes. a question about the first part of your talk where you introduced those dimensionality witnesses. Do you have an algorithm for to come up with a complete set of these witnesses or facets in the quantum and classical case responding?
Yes, so there is an algorithm in the sense that there's, for instance, software that does this. If you specify the vertices of some polytope, so maybe I should put back the picture.
So it's also in the quantum case? You mentioned that they might be nonlinear, right?
Right, yeah. So first of all, for the classical case, indeed, defining these vertices is quite easy. So then, indeed, in principle, I can go to a computer and find out what are, and the, you know, if the computer is powerful enough, it will spit out the facets here. But in general, okay, if you have lots of preparation and lots of measurements, it will be quite hard. Now, for the quantum case, indeed, as you said, so the set is not going to be a polytope in general, so one would need nonlinear witnesses. And yeah, here I have to say I don't know. So for the simple example that I mentioned, we were able to find one. But that was sort of inspired from what we know about non-locality. So it turns out that it works. But beyond that, no, I don't know. I have the feeling that it's quite a difficult problem.
Okay. So do I understand correctly, like in the classical case, is it exponential time? Like, or do you need like, you don't have polynomial time algorithm, right?
No, because yeah, finding the facets of a polytope is not polynomial.
I have one more question, which is when you go to higher dimension, would you generally expect the rates and the gap to get better? So if you've looked at qubits, this is this facet, but if you go to a higher dimensional system, then would you get a better security and rate?
Yeah, I would guess so somehow, because it seems that it's the gap between what quantum and classical systems of the same dimension can do that matters.
So sending pairs of photons, you know, in a row is kind of better than sending just one photon. It's kind of fun.
So also one idea that we had with Marcin was, so although in this example of QKD, we could show security of qubits against bits, it could also be the case that one could show security of qubits against against classical trits or classical four-dimensional systems. So, yeah, in principle, there is hope to improve here, but I'm not sure exactly how to do that yet.
It seems like as you just send more copies of the same size system, your rate's only dropping quite slowly, but if your security is getting better fast, then that's good.
Yeah.
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.